This is the Kitchen and Bathroom Design Podcast from Taylist Media in association with KBB Birmingham 2020.
Welcome to the Kitchen and Bathroom Design Podcast from Taylist Media. I'm Managing Editor Andy Davis. Now, this is our last episode before Christmas, so we've decided to see out 2019 with a very special interview with architectural designer and TV presenter Charlie Luxton. Now, you may know Charlie from his TV work on programmes such as Modern British Architects, Build a New Life in the Country, Homes by the Sea, Building the Dream. But he's also a very accomplished designer, of course, and his company specialises predominantly in sustainable living projects around the UK. Now, as you'll hear, he's a fascinating guy, very knowledgeable, very good company, and absolutely passionate about the part the design industry can and must play in tackling climate change. Go and have a look at his website, charlieluxtondesign.com, and you can see some of the projects he's been involved with, including, of course, the kitchens and bathrooms that they contain. Before we get stuck into that, a quick reminder that the Kitchen and Bathroom Design Podcast is brought to you with the help of our friends at KBB Birmingham 2020, the biggest kitchen, bedroom and bathroom show in the UK. And it's on at the NEC in Birmingham from March the 1st to the 4th at the NEC. You'll be able to see us there recording live versions of this podcast. So if that doesn't put you off at all, register your place now at kbb.co.uk. But enough of that, over to Charlie Luxton and I'll see you on the other side. Charlie, welcome to the Kitchen and Bathroom Design Podcast. Thank you very much for sparing us your time. Today we're here in the middle of central London, well, basically a week before Christmas, give or take. So here's a good question to start off with. What does one get an architectural designer for Christmas?
A nice pencil. Actually, pencils, I get my pencils, bizarrely, they're not that unusual, but the only place to get them is Japan. It's like, really? I have to get them imported, and they cost about £8 each, they're not expensive, and then you get taxed about £15 when you get a pencil here, because they do this propelling thing when you shake them.
Oh, I
got introduced to them by a friend who's a Japanese architect. He lives in London, and I've just fallen in love with them, so now I have to buy them off an internet auction site and get them sent. I get stung every time for the import license. So get them that, but don't get them stung with the import tax.
That's a brilliantly elaborate answer for the first question.
It's going to set the tone.
I thought you'd just say a ruler or a bag of cement or something, but I think an imported pencil from Japan.
Yeah.
I'm going to get emails now saying what is the brand of that, so I'll get that off you later.
Yeah, I can tell you, yes. It's a Pilot Dr. Grip black on black.
Right. That sounds, well, almost perverted, but I quite like the sound of it. So I want to sort of start off, because you're a high-profile guy, you've been on TV a lot, you're a well-known face in the world of design, but one of the things I ask people quite a lot is, can you remember when you first realised that design was something people did for a job?
Well, my dad was a graphic designer, advertising guy, so he started in graphics. Actually, he started in illustration, because there wasn't graphic design when he first started, so he started doing illustration. Actually learning down at Ealing School of Art, and he learned with some amazing artists like Frank Albar and people like that, really amazing painters. He then got into graphic design and then became an ad guy, basically, in Australia. So I knew about drawing as a thing and designing things that people liked, whether it was a flat thing. And you know, my parents really liked their house. You know, they bought a house in central Sydney, and it was full of rent-controlled flats all over the place, and they spent years doing it up. And so I sort of lived through building and transformation and, you know, making a pond in the garden. You know, it was always there. Yeah. And then my brother and I started, like, making tree houses when we were tiny. And then I got into really, then we moved to England, moved to a farm, and I got into really making dens, like, first of all, in the hay bales, and then anywhere I could make a den or a tree house, I'd do that. And that's sort of, I'm kind of aware of that recently, that probably was really seminal. It's just always making structures to be in, you know. And the best one was when we dug out underneath a disused industrial building and dug under the concrete slab and made a sort of den under the concrete slab when we were about 11.
That sounds astonishingly dangerous.
Well, it was a reinforced concrete slab, and we just went in underneath it.
That's more like a bunker than a den,
though. More like a bunker it was, yeah. So then it sort of just grew out of that. And I remember at about 13 going to place called Drogo Castle, Castle Drogo, sorry, down in Devon, which is designed by Lutyens. And it's actually the last sort of castle ever built in this country in 1914. It was like built for the sort of Sainsbury's of the day. They were large kind of greengrocers, if you like, but big scale. And it's a beautiful Lutyens building. And I remember sort of walking around and looking at the intersecting barrel vaulting and the way that the corridors kind of stepped, but you could always see past the corners to the next corner. And I just suddenly thought, oh, there's a lot to this. And it sort of started from that. I was about 13, and it started from there.
So would you sit down and sketch? Were you a drawer? Yeah. Were you
I was more of a maker.
Right, Lego and that kind of thing?
Welding.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, first of all the dens, and then lots of welding,
okay,
sculpture.
So incredibly dangerous for a child.
Yeah, welding angle grinders on a farm. And actually I paid my way all through university by selling metal sculpture. So that sort of, I just made stuff, really.
Your signature stuff, I suppose, which is, again, is then reflected in the TV shows that you've done, is the idea that design sort of fits into its environment. You know, these are things that are very complementary, sometimes literally fit into the environment by, you know, digging holes in things. The stories you're telling there very clearly set that out, that this is what you're always going to do. You're never going to be a sort of stark, contrasting, let's build a big chrome and glass thing in the middle of somewhere.
Yeah, no, I don't. Yes, I agree. I don't really... Maybe I don't have the confidence to do that. I don't really know. I'm the youngest of three boys, right? So I think I've always been about trying to get everyone to get along. And I think that sort of comes across in my architecture. I'm trying to help the kind of where I am get along with the building and with each other. And
so when you get a commission, say, in your professional life, as opposed to TV life, although that is clearly also professional, but you know what
I'm not sure. Don't tell anyone.
It's not a real job.
No, it's not a real job.
You know, is that what you are? Is that the first thing that goes through your mind, is how can I, you know, where is this thing going to sit, and how is this structure, this building, this design going to fit in with it?
Yeah, context is crucial. I mean, I think, you know, you look at where you're going to build and you try and understand how you can exploit the positives of the site as much as you can, obviously the brief and the client's ambitions. But yeah, I think most of what we do is about sort of respectfully adding to and fitting in rather than trying to kind of change the tune, if you like, of any kind of setting.
Because impact and being impactful is a big part of what design is. You're either setting up to be impactful or you're setting out to make as little footprint as possible. I think that you are in one school or the other.
Yeah, I think I'm definitely in the other one. I mean, a lot of my sort of, for example, when I started in university, a lot of those buildings were sort of tucked away into hillsides, and that always really... I think it comes, maybe you're right, I've never thought of it that way, but maybe you're right, maybe it comes from those dens that, you know, it's like, I just kind of want to make quite something quite quiet that's just wonderful to be in, looking out from, that's lovely.
I just have an image of you now pitching hay bales to pretty much every client of them. Going, no, let's just move back to...
Yeah, there's normally a green roof, but not always. Yeah.
So look, we talk about kitchens and bathrooms on this podcast, so I'm wondering whether you as a broader architectural designer... Where a kitchen or a bathroom might fit into your process? Do you see them as, you know, the kitchen, let's take that first. Do you see that very much as the heart of things that you would then build around it? Or is it a case of let's get the structure right and let's fit a kitchen into it?
No, I think, you know, one of the very first things you do on a project is to work out where you want to spend time. And so one of the very first questions you ask the client is, are you sitting room people or are you kitchen kind of people? And not that there's a judgment in that, but it's a really important divider, if you like, because some people do sit on the sofa, you know, they eat on the sofa and they sit on the sofa and they sit in their sitting room. I sit at the kitchen table, always have. I mean, we grew up in a house that had an arga. The rest of the house was so cold, it was freezing, but the kitchen was warm. So just always sat at the kitchen table or on the arga to keep warm. So I love the kitchen table. I see the kitchen table as the heart of a home, especially a family home. So, you know, once you've established where someone is likely to spend time, you know, the kind of priority moment for them, then you sort of build a kind of a diagram, if you like, about how you would live on that place. Irrespective, you know, maybe there's ideas of form and, you know, how you can twist the local vernacular and play with that and play with the site or the landscape. But really you're diagramming, like, where would I want to spend my time? You know, morning, evening, night, and then building around that. So the kitchen, you know, if the person answers the question, we like the kitchen table, then obviously the kitchen and that table within the kitchen is absolutely crucial to the experience of the home, and try and put in the kind of the prime spot, if you like.
Funny enough, we did a previous episode about open plan living and whether open plan living has gone too far. You know, that it's about space for the sake of space. So are you, what kind of designer are you? Would you like to see nooks and crannies and corners and a kitchen that is forms part of that? Or are you literally, let's open it all up and have one great big enormous?
No, I think it's about defining space and an open plan where the character of the space is uniform across all these different activities, sitting, eating, you know, cooking, sitting, you know, watching telly, I feel is... it's problematic, actually, and I built a little house in Cornwall with my brother recently, and we did that in the main space, and I've never been happy with it, and you know, it's quite an admission that I built a building I'm not happy with, but I'm going to retrofit it. He doesn't know that yet, but I'm going to change it around anyway. But no, and I think it's really important that you create characters for the different characters for the spaces that you're in. So I think, you know, it's a really hackneyed thing to say. It's not open plan, it's broken plan, yada yada yada. And we've all heard it, but I think there's a real truth to it that, you know, the connection of these living spaces is absolutely crucial. In fact, the connection of all the spaces in the house is really important. If you can make the house feel like a sort of manipulated flowing piece of space rather than a series of boxes normally stuck together, then I think you're starting to get somewhere into a kind of more interesting kind of way of living. So this idea that the broken plan and you create character, but then how do you run that plan through, right through the building so you don't feel this sense of box, box, box. I think that's really intriguing, quite hard to achieve.
Particularly, I think, if the building itself is in a very organic setting, like a lot of your stuff has been, literally homes by the sea, or it is these sort of dream homes that are set into hillsides and things, you don't want to then walk through the front door and see everything can kind of be angular and boxes. And
no. I do, do you know what I do love, though? I do love when you go to sort of early country houses before they invented the corridor, and you sort of go from a room to the next room, through a massive set of doors into the next room. There's something quite wonderful about that. Maybe that's an idea for a future. In fact, we're working on a grade one listed building at the moment, and that's like that. And that's just really interesting, you know, that these rooms are corridors as well as rooms, and you're trying to get your head around how you then divide the space up within them. But no, I think fundamentally, if you're trying to create a building that is sort of in harmony with sitting, you know, with the setting, you're trying to kind of break boundaries between inside and outside, not just with a big sliding door kind of way, then clearly trying to break boundaries throughout the whole internal experience is kind of crucial.
And bathrooms is, in a way, somehow the complete opposite. This is why these things are always interesting.
Yeah, but is it, though, you see?
Well,
because I love a bathroom with a view. So yes, actually, quite a lot of
it's not a family space, though.
You try telling that to my kids. Yeah, they haven't worked that one out yet. No, clearly, but I think there's, you know, I think it's amazing if you can design a bathroom that has this kind of privacy and view, you know, that you don't feel in any way overlooked, obviously, and you need that. I mean, I'm certainly not sort of extolling the virtues of exhibitionism, but, you know, just to be able to be tucked away in the building and look out. And because it's actually, there's this, it's funny, like the moments when you're in a building that you connect with the outside, that you really engage with view, are not the times that you normally think, right? So you'd think, oh, you know, I'm sat at the sofa and there's the massive view. That's not often when you really engage with it. It's often like when you walk down a corridor or you come to the top of some steps or you're cleaning your teeth in the bathroom. It's like, how often do you stand there for 2 minutes or whatever the beepy thing in your hand says and just stand there and stare? If you can be looking at a view, that's cool. You know, that's kind of really nice.
So what kind of designer are you when you've literally got to sit down and design something? What do you get? You've got your fantastically expensive pencils that you've imported.
Not expensive. They are, yeah, when they get here. They're not in Japan, though.
You've got your
They're like £8.
You've got your super Japanese pencil that you refuse to use anything else. What do you do? Are you a quick sketch guy? Do you get all the rulers and everything out?
No,
do you
I'm get a really computers? Messy sketcher.
Right.
I mean, there's a whole team. We're 8 people now, so, you know, I've sort of slightly disconnected from the physical drawing of things on a day-to-day basis. There's lots of sketching. Mm. There's a lot of sketching and sitting at the computer and trying things. And a lot of it we do through 3D modelling, you know, very rough and ready 3D modelling. Some of these modern, you know, modelling packages are just awesome. You know, the power is incredible. So you just go, well, let's just make it. You know,
are you an aficionado on that, or do you have a guy who does that for
no,
you?
No, I have people that do it. Yeah. Yes. No, I can do it. I can do it. And actually, you know, recently I designed my own house, and because I couldn't pull the team off their, you know, they were too busy, I ended up doing a lot of the drawing on that myself, and actually, like, hand, you know, actually on a computer, drew all the kitchens and, you know, did everything, did all the construction drawings and everything. And that's a really nice experience when you do that.
Which is interesting because you're your own client, because one of the things we see with...
No, actually, my wife was the client.
Oh, there you go, of course. Is yeah, the clients tend to like the kind of organic feel of looking at sketches and looking at drawings and liking the idea that they feel that you can do it as opposed to sitting at a computer screen and seeing a thing. Do you see that as well with the people that you have to work with?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm going to tell you a secret now, and no one else is going to hear, which is lucky. On the drafting package, the CAD package we use, there is a sketch function, which we initially, when we saw it, we were like, man, you can't use that. That's really cheating. We use it.
Yeah.
We actually use it because you can do a drawing of a plan, and if it's completely rectilinear and the client sees it, they feel like somehow it's done and the train's left the station and they don't feel like they've got on the train, you know. So, you know, we'll design something and then we'll backpedal it right back to, because we have to design to make sure it works, and then we backpedal it right back, do really simple, you know, do computer models and then put them through a process to make them look less and less computer made, which is important because it's about gesture. And we do the same thing with the plans, only at that early stage. I'm not sure I should admit that.
We'll tell nobody, don't worry.
That's good, man. Thanks for that.
One of the things I'm really interested in always is how articulate and how literate customers and clients are with design when they start talking. Because I think one of the things that has changed over the years is guys like you, and we had Oliver Heath on a few weeks ago, yeah, these guys that are on TV talking about design all the time have educated the customer to the point that when they do sit down in front of a professional designer, they can have a relatively literate conversation with them.
It's hard though, isn't it? Mm. Talking about design is really hard. You know, unpacking why you do and don't like something is really hard. And you know, normally it goes really well, but occasionally you come up against a client and it's just like, I just don't think this is the right match here. I'm really sorry, you know. I can certainly think of two occasions where that's happened, and I'm in the middle of one at the moment where there's a real kind of, we're just sort of missing each other. And that's fine, and it's really good if you can get people to articulate about design. And I think but it's a really hard thing to talk about, actually, because it's so personal normally, especially if it's a house. I mean, especially when you're talking about, you could be talking about an experience you had at a friend's house when you were 12 that's somehow locked into your subconscious about what you do and don't want from a home. And it's really hard to get people to go on that journey to unpack that. And half the time you end up, because we do mainly private houses, you know, you end up sort of really trying to drive into people's value sets. And that's, you know, that's an important part of it. Why are you doing this? You know, what does it mean to you? And then you can start to understand why they're judging and valuing things in the way they're seeing it. So it is really tough though. And I respect people who can sort of be open and candid, and because it's very easy to say, I like or dislike something, and you feel like someone's going to sort of tread on you for that, you know, that you're wrong. And no one's wrong. I think that's the first.
But people must come to you, though. Your sort of reputation must precede you a little bit because of your TV work. People must come to you for a certain look.
Well, you'd hope so. Well, I don't know, actually. No, because I don't know if we have a look. Do we? I don't think we've got you.
Well, no one's going to come to you for a kind of, you know, like I say, a chrome and glass skyscraper, are they?
You'd be surprised.
Really?
Yeah. not quite chrome and glass skyscraper. Yeah. No, I think there's something really important there, that if you're going to go to a designer, go to a designer that does what you're interested in. Like, you don't try and, you know, turn the super tanker or the, you know, turn the ship, because it will take ages to get around. Yeah. It's weird though that people come and expect you to do something that clearly you don't do.
It is, isn't it?
I think they think that you can just knock anything up, you know, but it's like, we're not going to do pastiche, I'm afraid. It's just not what we're not going to do. We're not going to do flim-flam. We're not going to do baubles, and it's just not what we do.
Is the opposite true, that they've seen something you've done on TV and they say, can you do that for me, please? And where they want it is completely inappropriate.
Yeah, I mean, you get people phoning up and saying, almost saying, can you design me a house? Or where's the site? Oh, I haven't got one yet. Right, well, okay, that's really hard to design a building without a site.
I like that Teletubbies one that you dug into the side of the hill.
Yeah,
can you do that in the middle of, you know.
Something like that, yeah, okay.
Switch. Well, look, let's sort of switch gear a little bit and talk about, obviously, a subject that's very, that you're very much an evangelist for, which is the sustainability side of things.
Yep.
That's something obviously you're very passionate about. What is the current health of that, do you think, within this sector? Do you think that it's filtering through slowly but surely, or do you think there's been a revolution? Where do you think it sits at the moment?
I think there's been a conceptual revolution. I think that the penny has dropped, and what's amazing is, you know, people have been jumping and shouting for 25 years about this, and I think there's been a sort of coming together of, I think you'd have to be pretty blind not to see the actual effects of climate change now starting to be very noticeable, and that's even with the bad kind of wiring that humans have to miss these long-term trends. I mean, we're like really badly wired for picking up on climate change. We're really badly wired for making small sacrifices today for big gains like down the line. We're terrible at that. I mean, those are the things that really keep me up at night about climate change. Having said that, we are now going, wait a second, like all these fires and like the flooding and the heat and the, what, is this right? And that's happened. And I think also what's happened is that the people communicating about it are, it's becoming a human story. And, you know, Greta and David Attenborough and, you know, they can put a face to it. And I think when it's a fact and a figure, it's really hard for people to get emotional about it. You know, a small percentage can, you know, see the model that the numbers predict or describe and get excited. But for most people, it's like, no, give me a face, give me a figure, give me a story, and then I can connect to this and change. So conceptually, I think there has been a real leap in the last year and a half, which is exciting. Because of those uniquely bad wiring that the brain that we have as humans, I'm still deeply worried that we're not actually going to act quick enough and fast enough and realize that the actions that we as an individual make are the things that are causing climate change. It's not some other. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's not them over there. It's not that person down there. It's things you do too. And I think that's really when it's going to be hard. And in the design industry, you know, when buildings, the energy used in buildings to produce buildings, to build buildings, whatever, is about 40% of the global emissions. You know, we as designers involved in that area have got an enormous responsibility. I mean, we are right at the front line of this issue. And we need to be radically changing the way that we operate, radically changing the way that we advise our clients, you know, and trying to reuse and, you know, keep, not just tear stuff out, but refresh. And so, you know, there's a huge culture change there.
I mean, obviously, the kitchen and bathroom market, there's too much conversation, I think, about the sustainability of the materials that are used. Of course, that is obviously incredibly important. But I think where the design has to fit in more is in whether or not they facilitate a sustainable lifestyle for the people that are using it. Because obviously, if you put a bathroom into your house, it's going to stay there for 10 years. So there's a relative amount of sustainability in that. There's nothing disposable about those products that are going in. I mean, there will be eventually.
Well, they shouldn't be 10 years. It should be 20 years. Exactly. You know what I mean? If it's well built and done simply in classic design, it can be 20, 30 years.
But what I haven't seen enough of, I don't think, is how those rooms can facilitate a day-to-day sustainable lifestyle. Mm. Because in a kitchen, for example, it's about the hot water, it's about the energy, it's about the appliances. But it's also about the waste, the food waste, the plastic, the wrapping, the packaging, and whether or not they're building enough into those rooms that assist in the storage of that, the manipulation of that. And in bathrooms, it's all about obviously water use, hot water, but also about packaging and, you know, the stuff from toiletries and the chemicals in the toiletries and all those things. And that's where I think the design is a little bit of a gap.
I think so. I think you can nudge, but fundamentally, you know, the choices you make of the food you buy is really going to impact the amount of energy that uses. I think the one biggest thing as a kitchen and bathroom specify designer you can do is do not specify any tropical hardwoods ever unless they're reclaimed. Just don't do it. Do not buy PFSC, FSC. Now, they can go in, and there's been a lot of evidence recently about, you know, selective felling in rainforests is really destructive because it sort of breaks the kind of the mesh of the forest and it allows people in. And I've seen it. I've seen people going down logging roads and clear felling rainforest. And if you ever see clear felled rainforest and don't burst into tears, you're a harder man than I, because it is the most destructive, horrible thing you will ever see in your life. And so when you say to the client, no, it's fine, we'll have an Iroko or a teak or a blah, 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 that's what you're doing. So just stop it, okay?
But is there a gap? I mean, you've done TV shows about dream homes. You know, when people want dream projects, they want their dream kitchen or their dream bathroom that they've always ever wanted in their life. You're coming up against a barrier there, aren't you, of people thinking that they might have to compromise on their dream in order to...
But this education, if you explain to someone that your dream is going to result in the loss of 5 acres of rainforest, or, you know, I mean, I'm making up a figure here, so please don't ascribe that, but that your dream is contributing to the destruction of the rainforest and the loss of biodiversity, I think most people go, is there another option? You know, at that point, you know.
Now, yeah. Yes, and I think that's what's changed. Because yeah. If 2 or 3 years ago, I don't think that.
Yeah, but nobody would have actually pulled them up on them.
That's
if
true.
You pull people up on this stuff, like, do you really want monkey death? Do you know? That's a very big way of putting it. But, you know, I say it tongue-in-cheek.
That's a slogan we're going to take, I'm sorry.
I say that tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, I genuinely do say that. It's like, I'm just not into that because of monkey death. I like monkeys. Do you like monkeys?
Well,
don't have tropical rainforests.
Do you want monkey death, Mrs. Smith? I'm not sure that's what you want. Oh, I didn't know there'd be monkey death involved. Well,
you know, it's a beautiful kitchen. That's okay. You know, most people won't say that. Most people are reasonable when you speak to them.
You are, as I say, you are an evangelist for this. You talk about it a lot, quite right. Are you confident about it, or do you still feel we're fighting a losing battle here?
I think if we manage to avert significant climate change that's disruptive to our civilization and way of life, we'll be lucky.
I mean, you and I are, you'd never know it looking at us, but you and I are quite similar ages. I'm probably 2 or 3 years older than you. So we're from a generation where we grew up with a nuclear war threat over us.
Yeah.
But that was a very specific thing, as you say.
It could or couldn't happen, it was binary.
Yeah, you could identify that, there were people involved, it was Gorbachev, it was Reagan, it was, you know, the sort of mutually assured destruction of things was quite a tangible thing. Unfortunately, you're not going to get... Apollo Creed wasn't killed by, you know, CO2 emissions, was he?
The bottom line is, that's one thing. That's what I think. But that almost doesn't matter. Because there's a great thing, like, when you learn to drive, right? What is the driving instructor? Let's say you're trying to drive through two posts, you know, all the bollards on your driving thing. What do they say? They say, don't stare at the post. Because if you stare at the post, you're going to drive into the post. Stare at the gap. So I think, you know, we could sit here and talk about climate change and how bad it's going to be. And in a way, I think you just got to package that up and go, it's going to be really pretty bad, I think, and put that away and stare for the gap. Like, well, what does this carbon-free, actually just kinder to the planet existence look like? You know, and that's really exciting. Like, where does the food come from? You know, realistically, we're not killing millions and billions of animals, you know, millions and millions of animals a year, probably billions of animals a year. To have that kind of lifestyle in 20, 30, 40 years' time, I doubt that's happening. We're not cutting down rainforests. We're not doing these kind of things. We've probably got a much more equitable society because you've got to be kinder to each other if you're going to be kinder to the planet, right? Because the whole point is like, well, I'm just going to dump crap on the planet because that's not my problem. It's like, I'm just going to keep people poor because that's not my problem. It's actually all of our problems. So my suspicion is that there is a kind of a really virtuous thing that could happen out of this. And that's the thing I really want to focus on, not, you know, the icebergs melting and how bad that's going to be, because I don't think that hasn't worked yet. You know?
Well,
that's not a story that sells. And the other way of thinking about it is like when the pilgrims set off to America, right? Yes, they set off because of the religious persecution. They went because of the utopia they were going to build, right? Mm. Not because of how crap it was here. It's because where they believed they were going to get to. So we've got to find that place, and that's what we've got to go for. Takeouts I want, you know, that I'd like, you know, anyone listening is, A, don't buy tropical rainforests or starboards unless it's recycled. And secondly, just like, question your clients about tearing out a kitchen. I know you're doing yourself out of a job, but can you refurbish, refresh, renew? You know, and if you're going to buy something, can you persuade them to get something secondhand or get something really high quality handmade by someone so it lasts them for 40 years, not disposable? Really fight, push back on the trench showers, guys. You know, just really, come on, we don't need that much water consumption. And think about the energy consumption within the building, like beyond, you know, like if you reduce the energy demand in these things, that the whole house gets more efficient. There's knock-ons for that. So, you know, there are things that... It's all those little decisions that we all make that are going to add up to this systemic change. And so you as an individual, whoever you are listening or you sat across the table, you have a responsibility to make those changes with your day-to-day decisions too.
Well, let's conclude here by talking about you and your home, because you famously have built your own home.
Right, yes.
And yeah, you've talked a little bit about that already. What's the kitchen like in your home? What did you go for?
I designed it myself. I made it with Kitchen George. He's about 3 miles away. It's mainly European oak. It's got a thick oak edge with a kind of recessed little handle detail that I got very excited about. And I've got a stainless steel work surface on the back where the sink is. I love it. It was a kind of prototype. There's a couple of things about it that don't quite work, but...
Like what?
The doors are quite thick, and I'm struggling to find a hinge that can throw the doors wide enough so that you can open all the doors at the same time. Which is a bit annoying, but I've got completely used to it. I don't care. That's a bit annoying, but I designed it, so it's fine.
I'm guessing there's a massive kitchen table in the middle.
there's a massive, it's actually an old door that was the door between my two kids' bedrooms when we had lived in an old cottage, and we divided it with a big door, which is made out of secondhand wood when it was made, and now it's become the table.
Wow.
It's this massive door table. So, you know, we're getting the most out of it. And then I made all the shelving out of folded mild steel and stuff. I flipping love my kitchen.
Yeah.
I put a lot of time, and you know, it's that thing of, you know, you do a sketch, but when you're actually drafting all the details and working out all the spacings and getting the prototypes made for the little hat, I really loved it.
With Kitchen George.
With Kitchen George, yeah.
Brilliant.
He's got a tractor collection.
Kitchen George has got a tractor collection?
Yeah.
How many tractors does he have in his collection?
12.
He's got 12 tractors?
Yeah, all green. So what are they? They're John Deere's. He likes John Deere's. He's about 33 and he's got a massive tractor collection.
Where does one keep a tractor collection?
In a big barn.
Of course.
He's great though. George Walgrove, if you want a kitchen, he's amazing.
Especially if you need it brought to you.
Yes,
it's incredibly heavy over some
uneven ground. Actually, it's near Christmas, and I think around this time, where we live, I live up in North Oxfordshire, just on the edge of the Cotswolds, and this time, the farmers cover their tractors in lights and drive around the local villages.
Oh,
it's
superb.
Flipping brilliant.
Well, look, what about the bathroom then? What have you done with the bathrooms in that house?
Very simple. It's tropical hardwood, right. But it's old lab desks from schools, reclaimed from schools, okay. in the main bathroom. I designed Kitchen George, although this time it was Bathroom George. I designed a unit, and we made a unit with a big wide sort of double shared sort of sink, trough sink thing. And then it's just mainly really beautiful tiles, actually, from Spain, really nice tiles. In fact, big find I've had recently that we're using a bit of is these, in Manchester, they're making tiles out of crushed up old bathroom, like
sanitary ware,
ceramic.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, they crush it up and make it, and they're beautiful colours, like pinks and green, blues, and get from Parkside Design, that's where I get them from, but they're really lovely recycled tiles, so that's good.
So this brings us full circle, really, because basically you've built yourself a den, haven't you?
I have. Building your own house was really emotional because I was the contractor, so I built it. I was literally doing the reinforcing start rod and, you know, It was crazy. It was really, I'm still slightly traumatised by it, but the sense of satisfaction was quite vast.
Well, look, Charlie, thank you so much for your time today.
It was really enjoyable.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas to you.
You too.
Thank you. Charlie Luxton there. A big thank you to him for taking the time out to talk to us. He's a very busy man. And a really interesting guy, and I think you'll probably agree his enthusiasm for what he does is very genuine and is absolutely infectious. But that's it for 2019, though. I hope you've enjoyed this first run of the Kitchen and Bathroom Design Podcast. We'll be back in January 2020, so please subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you don't miss that first episode when it comes out. Merry Christmas and a very Happy New Year from everyone here at Taylor's Media. See you in 2020.
Kitchen and Design Podcast is brought to you with the support of our friends at KBB Birmingham 2020, the biggest kitchen and bathroom exhibition in the UK. It's on from March the 1st to March the 4th, 2020, and we'll be there recording live episodes for this very podcast every afternoon. You can register for your place at kbb.co.uk. See you there.